Hello, everyone, and welcome to Science by the Slice. This is Philip Stokes here, your host of the podcast, and I'm joined by our speaker for today's episode, Shelley Rampold. Hello. Welcome.
Hi, Philip. Thanks for having me.
We're going to hear more about hemp and public opinion of hemp and all those the research that you have run in this episode. But before that, there's some news, kind of some bittersweet news that I thought you could share with us. You've been with the Pi Center now for 4 years almost.
Yeah, almost.
And we're excited that you have a new opportunity, but also sad to see you go. So tell us a little bit about that.
So I recently accepted a position at the University of Tennessee. I'll be moving there as an assistant professor, and my focus will be in crisis and issues management and communication. So essentially, I will be working with industry members and organizations to help manage or mitigate current or emerging crises in our industry, which is really great because I feel like a lot of my time at the Pi Center and the opportunities that I've had here have really prepared me for that type of job. So it is bittersweet. I'm really going to miss everyone, but I'm really excited to have been here and gotten the experiences that I've had to prep me for this next step.
Well, we are excited for you as well. But of course, we will miss you. So I think that's a good transition to today's episode because this is an emerging issue, industrial hemp. So what do you say? We just roll the tape.
Let's do it.
This is Science by the Slice, a podcast from the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences Center for Public Issues Education. In this podcast, experts discuss the science of issues affecting our daily lives, reveal the motivations behind the decisions people make, and ultimately provide insight to solutions for our lives.
Hello again. Philip Stokes here, Education Coordinator with the Pi Center and host of Science by the Slice. This is part two of our series on industrial hemp, and in this episode, we're discussing public perception of hemp. You'll hear my conversation with Dr. Shelley Rampold, Research Coordinator with the Pi Center, who, of course, you've already heard from, and she'll explain the current beliefs and knowledge levels of Floridians around this subject. But before that, what's been the public opinion around hemp leading up to this study? Pew Research Center and Gallup have both been tracking U.S. public opinion on legalizing marijuana since 1969. Now, before I go further, I want to remind everyone that hemp is not the same thing as marijuana, as you heard in part one of this series. However, also remember, hemp wasn't distinguished from marijuana until the 2014 Farm Bill. So, according to Pew and Gallup, in 1969, only 12% of Americans believed marijuana should be legal. But in 2019, for Pew and 2020 for Gallup, 67% and 68% of Americans respectively thought marijuana should be legal. When you take a closer look, according to the Pew study in 2019, 91% of Americans thought marijuana should be legal, either for medical use only or for both medical and recreational use. So clearly, public opinion around cannabis is trending up, especially when compared to the time period leading up to the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, when the film Reefer Madness debuted the previous year.
Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell. In this film, you will see the ease with which this vicious plant can be grown in your neighbor's yard, rolled into harmless-looking cigarettes, hidden in an innocent shoe or watch case.
While this clip was about the dangers of marijuana, I personally found it funny that they refer to cigarettes as harmless. And once again, if we haven't said it enough, hemp is not marijuana, but it was around the time period of this film being released when hemp lost favor as an agricultural commodity due partly to the growing concern of the hallucinogenic properties found in cannabis sativa. With that, let's join in on my conversation with Dr. Rampold as she's introducing the study she conducted in the Pi Center.
I was contacted by Dr. Zachary Brim, and he was interested in conducting a social science aspect of this.
So what we did was we developed a survey, and we conducted that with Florida residents. And the purpose, it was a pretty big survey instrument. And the purpose of this was to assess their objective knowledge, so their actual knowledge, what they do and don't know about hemp and hemp production. Their subjective knowledge, so that's like their self-perceived knowledge, what they think they know about hemp topics. And then we also asked about their attitude toward legalizing hemp production, because we do have hemp license holders in the state of Florida now. And we also asked about their attitudes toward legalizing marijuana, because prior research has shown that and the history of hemp shows that there's historically been a strong association between the two. So we figured we might as well take a look at that. We also forced them to answer if they had to pick a stance, would they be overall for or against, or are they overall for or against legalizing hemp cultivation and production? And then we asked some open-ended questions to dig a little bit deeper, where they could do text entry responses to explain that stance. So if they said that they were overall for it, we asked them to list the top three reasons why they were overall for it. If they were overall against it, we asked them to, again, list those top three reasons why. And then we dug through some of that data to identify themes to further explain whether they're for or against it. And then we asked a couple of other questions about personal relevance. So we asked, you know, if they thought it impacted them, their state, if it was personally relevant to them. And then another measure of personal relevance was their use of it. You know, are they using ingestible or topical hemp products? What kind of products, et cetera? And then we've wrapped it up with some questions specific to the hemp pilot project. If they've heard about it, if they did hear about it, how did they hear about it? What are some questions that they had moving forward that perhaps we could get out there in some communication materials and highlight as part of the program? So that was in a nutshell kind of what the purpose of that research was.
So why would you get all this information, all that stuff that you just talked about? You get all this information. What can you do with that? Why is it important to know that information? Why would Zach Brim want to know that information? Why would it be important to the hemp pilot project here at the University of Florida?
Well, that's a good question. And I think the best way to answer that is to use other examples. I always call it the GMO fiasco, because we already know that with genetic modification, there's a lot of public opinion about it. We can't get back now. We can't put that toothpaste back in the tube, I guess, if you will. And so before we ended up with a situation like that, with this new agricultural commodity that's not been incredibly highlighted yet, that the public isn't incredibly aware of yet, we wanted to go ahead and get out there and figure out where some of those knowledge gaps were, what are some of their concerns that we can start marketing now. We still don't know if hemp is going to be a viable commodity in Florida. We're still learning. I'm sure I believe you talked with Dr. Brim about that. We're still learning if hemp can even grow well in Florida. You know, is there a future for it here? But if there is, consumer buy-in is going to be incredibly important, just like with any other agricultural technology or new crop or anything like that. Consumers drive the market. So we want to make sure that the knowledge they need is out there as we're reintroducing hemp production into the United States.
So I'm curious to learn about, what do people know about hemp? If you could just summarize, and then we can kind of break down some of those things.
Yeah. So first, I think it's important to note how we assessed objective knowledge. The way we did it is just like if you would take a test in school, a multiple choice test with a correct answer. And what we found was, on average, the respondents answered about 50% of the questions correctly. So that was the average test score, about 50%. And I do want to point out that that's not an incredibly low test score for these public knowledge assessments that we do, which makes sense, because nobody is an expert in everything. So that doesn't necessarily indicate really low knowledge. It just doesn't indicate that they have really high levels of knowledge either. So I think you're just kind of looking at a mixed bag there with knowledge.
So that is, I think, a really interesting thing to say, because when I hear 50%, you know, I can't go back and tell my third grade teacher that when I got my 50% on my spelling exam or whatever, you know, Shelley, you know, 20 years from now said that that's actually not too bad. So I'm not going to go home and slap that on the refrigerator. But like you said, I mean, ideally, right, with in school, right, we've been studying for this particular subject. We've been exposed to these things. We should generally know them if we've kind of put in the time. You mentioned that they had, helped me out, perceived knowledge of things, right? So there's actual knowledge, right? And then what they think they know, right? So how did those things compare, right? Based on what they really knew and then what they said, actually, what they thought they knew prior to taking those objective questions, if that makes sense.
Yes. So probably the most interesting association there when you're comparing actual knowledge versus what they thought they knew. Overall, they were pretty on par. And again, that's kind of what we've been seeing a lot with some of these. The public in general seems to be fairly self-aware of what they do or don't know. Now, whether that they take that into consideration when forming their beliefs is a different story, but that seems to track with across topics, and it's true of hemp too. Overall, the level of what they think they know was pretty reflective of what they actually knew. There was one area though where that wasn't the case. So we did ask a couple of questions to have them indicate some similarities and differences between hemp and marijuana. And we also asked them about CBD and THC. So we had about a fourth of respondents incorrectly believe that cannabis oil, CBD, is a psychoactive compound found in cannabis plants. CBD is not a psychoactive compound found in cannabis plants. We also had a fourth of respondents who incorrectly believe that both hemp and marijuana can be mind-altering if consumed and are primarily used for recreational purposes. On the subjective side of this, though, they strongly agreed that they knew what CBD and THC were, but their objective knowledge answers to that didn't reflect that, where there was definitely some confusion about if you can get high from hemp and if CBD oil, like those products, are mind-altering. So that was kind of one of the biggest, I would say one of the most interesting findings in that section, and definitely would be a key piece for future marketing of just, hey, here's what this is. Here's what it does. Here's what it doesn't do.
I want to take a quick pause to provide a little more context to what Dr. Rampol just explained. You may remember from part one of this series with Dr. Brim that there are three production systems for cannabis sativa: the grain system for food, the fiber system, and then flower production. The cannabinoids that Dr. Rampol just mentioned come from the unpollinated female flowers where you can extract these essential oils. CBD, or cannabidiol, is the compound used primarily for medicinal products that may be used to treat things like epilepsy or chronic pain, just as examples. THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, is the psychoactive compound associated with getting high. But remember, hemp, regardless of its use, cannot contain greater concentrations than 0.3% THC by dry weight, as defined by state and federal laws. So as Dr. Rampold was explaining, there's definitely some confusion about these differences, and I might say understandably so. Here's Dr. Rampold continuing the conversation about the misunderstanding between hemp and marijuana.
Another interesting finding in the differences is about use of hemp and marijuana for recreation. The correct answer is that marijuana is what's primarily used for recreation, right? We know this. If you've ever watched any movie with Seth Rogen, you know that marijuana is used primarily for recreation. But we had over a fourth of respondents indicate that both are used for recreation. So there's a misunderstanding that hemp is a let's go out and get high type product, whereas that's not necessarily the case. Hemp is primarily used for medical purposes, for fibers, you know, ropes, papers, things like that, and not for party purposes.
So that's a good point. So in the survey, were people using hemp products? Because maybe that is one area where they're getting some amount of information or knowledge if they're using hemp products, whether it's for, I don't know, I won't even go into which types, but what have you found in the survey of whether people are using hemp products or not?
So the majority said that they don't use hemp products, whether those are ingestible or topical. And so I think that contributes. I didn't specifically analyze this from a data standpoint, but I would suspect that that would contribute to some misunderstanding in the purposes of hemp products, because if you don't use it, then, you know, you wouldn't know. I've never had a child. So if you were to ask me a bunch of questions about what prenatal vitamins or different uses of child related things, I wouldn't really be able to answer that because I've never used them. So I think that that makes a little bit of sense here. I also want to point out that 10% of respondents indicated that they were unsure of whether or not they used hemp products. And that's not a huge, you know, percentage, but it's enough that there are people out there who have no idea if they're even using hemp products. So I think that speaks to an area of communication or marketing that maybe needs to get out there of here's what hemp is, here's how it's used. You might not even know it, but hemp is in this, this, and this, or that might be something that would be beneficial moving forward.
Currently, based on what you found, what are people's attitudes toward the legalization of hemp? And what would the people's attitudes be if there was an increase in production of hemp? What did you find people think about it?
So what I found consistently through this is that they don't think about it. When it comes to attitudes, those were largely neutral. That was kind of in the, not really one way or another. They were more slightly positive than negative, those attitudes, but they were still overall just largely neutral. And that was reinforced throughout the data when asking them to explain some things, when asking, going back to use of hemp products, you know, having a lot of people not use them, not having a lot of information or knowledge about it. So it's just kind of a general sense of apathy of, you know, kind of one way or the other. However, if you've ever been on any social media outlet ever, you know that neutral, apathetic attitudes can change overnight. You know, you might have zero opinions about some celebrity, and then that celebrity is posted on Facebook, and now you have every single opinion in the world and are expressing that opinion all over. So that neutral, just because they're neutral or apathetic now, that just means there isn't content out there being posted for someone to talk about. But the moment it is, then those conversations begin, and then attitudes get formed, especially if it becomes politicized or if different groups feel pressure to conform a certain way with those beliefs. So that's another goal of this is if information starts getting out there or hemp is kind of brought to light in the ag marketing sphere and those neutral attitudes shift, which way are they going to shift or what factors might explain which way they shift?
That's really interesting that you brought that point up. Kind of what I'm thinking about, I'm visualizing almost like there's a vacuum or like a void. If someone's neutral, it's like there's space to be filled. You know what I mean? That's kind of where I went in my head. So I would assume that one of the important things from a science communication standpoint, or even an agricultural production standpoint of hemp, would just be filling it with factual information, with, you know, real and accurate information, based on, you know, what are the realities of this product. Is that somewhat correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so even though the attitude assessment, you know, showed pretty neutral attitudes, when we forced them to pick a stance, because when we asked about attitudes, it's just kind of a little scale, overall bad, overall good, harmful, beneficial, dangerous, safe. So there was a neutral midpoint option, and people tend to do that. If they don't have strong opinions, they just go right down the middle. But then we forced them by asking, if you had to pick a stance, would you say you were overall for or against the decision to legalize the growing and processing of hemp? And that gave us some pretty interesting results, because if they said yes, we asked them to explain why. And if they said no, we asked them to explain why. So that gave us a little bit more insight too in moving forward.
Were there any concerns? I know you said generally people were neutral, but...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So on average, when you take all the data together, those attitudes were pretty neutral. But then, like I said, we forced them to kind of pick a stance if you had to be in one camp or the other. The majority of respondents were overall for legalizing, the decision to legalize hemp. But a fourth of respondents were overall against it. And then we asked why. And that was incredibly interesting and probably my favorite part of the study, going through that open-ended. You never know what someone behind a computer with no face is going to type in there. And that was incredibly fun to go through. So when we asked them to list their top three reasons why they indicated they were overall against the decision to legalize hemp, the specific answers were, you know, unique and interesting, but together they created some pretty general and very useful, as far as future direction goes, themes. So the most prominent theme that we saw emerge among the anti-hemp respondents were concerns about dangerous abuse and misuse. And that's where that was probably the section where the actual responses were most interesting. So for example, it was, we don't need more potheads. Teens are going to be irresponsible and drive drunk. Stop sitting on the sofa and getting high. No more stoners. It's dangerous to one's health. It's addictive. It should be under a doctor's care. We don't know the effects of pot on individuals. So you see that word pot coming in mm-hmm. when we're talking about hemp. We have enough drugs due to the Mexican drug cartel. So these answers were kind of, that again, kind of shows that association, the longstanding association between hemp and marijuana. And it goes back again to that, the knowledge stuff we were talking about, where some of those discrepancies in their subjective or objective knowledge and where they really were missing answers was on the ability to get high from hemp and the THC concentrations of hemp versus marijuana. So that some of those qualitative responses just further supported that, okay, this is if we're going to get out here and talk about hemp, this is going to have to be one of the main things that we discuss. You know, we'll serve as warning, please don't smoke this.
Right. And like you said, those answers were very telling, particularly around the lack of knowledge around hemp. And you can't, not to blame anyone for that. I mean, that's just a result of our culture, of what we know about, what we've heard about these products over time, right?
Well, I do have to give, you know, the public some credit here, though, with the lack of knowledge, because that was a second theme that came about, was lack of knowledge, in that they said that they were overall against it because they didn't know enough about it and wanted more information before making a decision. So it's kind of one of those, I don't know if this would be good or bad, so I'm going to say no, like a better safe than sorry approach, you know? And I mean, I don't want to assume, but I think a lot of us do that in our everyday lives of, will this be good? I don't know, but not having it won't be bad. So they were pretty self-aware. They said they wanted more knowledge to make a decision, which is great because that's what we want. Our goal isn't to advocate one way or the other. Our goal isn't to find ways to push someone in a certain direction. Our goal is, as agricultural or science communicators, is to simply present the information needed so people can make informed decisions that are best for them and their family. You know, what they decide is best for them and their family and their state and their community is going to differ. And that's why we have so many disagreements. And that's one thing, but the disagreements based on just a lack of knowledge needed to make decisions is a whole different story. So it is good that they're open to, I want to know more.
Right. That's a good point. What are some of the reasons to want to have an legalization and increased hemp production?
So when we looked at the responses from the group that said if they had to pick a stance, they would be overall for it. Some of the themes there, the first one was medical and health benefits. And this haven't dug into it, but I would suspect if I broke this down into people who use and don't use hemp products, that those who are using them are who contributed a lot to this area, noting the different medical and health benefits of like CBD oil for stress, for arthritis, you know, for other topical reasons. There was response upon response about medical or health benefits, and, you know, including personal testimonies. We had a lot in there saying, I use, you know, this for my arthritis and I wouldn't use anything else. And, you know, this changed, you know, my spouse's situation, et cetera. So we got a lot of that. We also had people note the diversity of use of hemp products, which does indicate that there's some knowledge out there of the fact that hemp does produce a wide variety of products. So that was a lot of the pro-hemp responses. They talked about paper, rope, building materials, clothing, fabrics, CBD oil, food and nutrition. They also noted the economic benefits. People who were overall for it thought that this would be a good opportunity to boost the economy, that it would be beneficial specifically beneficial for farmers. That kind of emerged as a sub-theme. The potential for it to be a new cash crop, for crop diversification for farmers, which is really awesome to see people specifically, because we didn't lead into that in any way. There was no leading question about the benefit for farmer. They provided that response on their own about crop diversification and new potentials for farmers. And then going back to the kind of apathetic neutral, a big theme was kind of why not. They said, well, I'm not against it. I don't see any reason not to. So it's kind of the opposite of the other group who tends to go who went the safe rather than sorry. I don't know enough about it. I don't really see the purpose, so I'm going to say no. And then on the pro side, you had the same thing of, well, I don't know, but I don't see any reason not to. So why not? It's just kind of the two different personality groups, I guess, in people of how you approach with caution or sure, let's try it. And then my favorite smaller theme in this group comes back. We see this a lot. It comes back to civil liberties of yes, it should be legal because that is not the government's job to regulate this. Or if I want to grow it, I should be able to grow it. And I wasn't really, I don't know if I was expecting to see that, but I did see that in the responses of kind of, I don't really care what the topic is, but I think it should be legal because we have civil liberties. So that's something interesting to further explore.
So that's interesting going back to some of the more positive associations. So I heard people were associating it with medical and health benefits, potential economic benefits, the fact that there's just a great diversity of use among this product, which are all things that I think maybe people in the industry are already saying, right? So, I mean, those are the same. People are kind of on the same page with that. They're affirming the actual kind of reality or potential reality of where we're going in the future with hemp production, which is cool, right? I mean, that's a good thing.
It is. The findings of the public survey I found to be very reflective of the same attitudes, hopes, and concerns in conversations with industry professionals. I don't have data analysis on that to, you know, scientifically look at those results, but based on, because I had to work with the, you know, different industry professionals in developing this, based on those conversations, what the public said is pretty reflective of that, you know, the positives, but then the same concerns, some of the concerns that the public expressed, you know, about the ability of federal or local agents to get out there and distinguish between hemp and marijuana plants that are just out in the field. Those are the same concerns that industry folks have. Those are same considerations, you know, that warrant attention in the industry. So the public's kind of reflecting on those, which is nice that there's some alignment there.
And I got to think that maybe one of those concerns or one of the reasons for why people are concerned that regulators wouldn't be able to distinguish the difference between the two is because we have such a long history of negative feelings towards marijuana, right? I mean, am I reading into that too much? We grow up thinking that it's we've been told it's a really bad drug, and I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but that's kind of what culture has been telling us. And so the idea that people could mistake or potentially use this opportunity where we're legalizing hemp to actually grow marijuana, the reason that's scary is maybe because we have some of these longstanding associations.
Oh yeah, I would say so. So some extra more robust data analysis that I conducted, I was looking at several variables in their ability to predict attitudes toward legalizing hemp cultivation and production, and attitude towards legalizing marijuana was the strongest predictor of that. And it was a significant and positive correlation. So meaning people with more positive attitudes toward legalizing hemp were more likely to have more positive attitudes toward legalizing marijuana. So that would make sense that a concern would be the ability for federal agents to distinguish between the two. Because if you didn't really care if marijuana was being grown, then you wouldn't care if they needed to distinguish between the two. For those, at least for drug-related concerns. Now, whether that we didn't dig in to know if their concerns about that were specifically because of you know, drug-related issues, or if it was a taxation issue. I mean, that could be. I mean, I don't want to assume.
Right.
If I had to guess, I would say drug-related, but it could be other things too, of right. Proper taxing and et cetera, et cetera.
So there's a lot of really interesting information. So as we're moving forward, and after talking with Dr. Zach Brim, it sounds like hemp is grows fairly well in the state of Florida, and that there probably will be an increased market for hemp going in the future. These are things we can't say for certain, but these are just kind of where the trends are leading us right now. So what would be your recommendations from this study moving forward, and in ways to just sort of inform the public as we go forward, as maybe hemp production also increases?
So I think a first good step would be to start at the local level, instead of trying to do kind of a top-down campaign or something. I think it could be beneficial to use the UF IFAS Industrial Hemp Pilot Project as an avenue for getting some of that information out there. We do see across studies, when we ask about source trustworthiness, the university never ranks low. Then it might not be the highest in compared to whatever else we're looking at the time, but the university usually ranks pretty high in trustworthiness. So we might as well capitalize on that and use this pilot project to highlight some of these things. And right now, the public that at least who participated in this study, most of them hadn't heard of the pilot project, didn't know anything about it, didn't know where to get information, but they had a lot of questions. You know, they wanted to know who was conducting it, who was the lead on it, who was involved in it, who was consulted in it, how did they decide which varieties to grow? They also had questions about who was in charge of overseeing regulations. You know, that's a great question. So if we can answer that question in the small scale with the pilot project of here's how it's being regulated, et cetera, that's just more bite-sized and digestible, I guess, to kind of start explaining how some of this is going to roll out. And then people did express an interest in it and wanted to know more. So I think if we start kind of at the local level with these pilot projects and use them as a way to start highlighting hemp revival, that could be a good approach. I also think that at some point there will likely be a need for a cohesive kind of multi-state branding approach. You know, and this wouldn't be the first time dairy has done it. Soybean does it. a lot of different agricultural commodities, kind of citrus has a very, I mean, you know, the citrus industry has a very kind of cohesive branding approach. So I think at some point when it gets bigger, that could also be pretty beneficial for, all right, folks across states. I mean, you have your own marketing, obviously, but what are some consistencies we probably need to have, you know, going forward? But I think that's kind of later down the road. It's still emerging. But I think that could be another important consideration.
Right. Yeah. And one thing after talking with Zach Brehm, I mean, he just made it very apparent that, you know, his role and the role of the IFAS hemp pilot project is, it's really exploratory. It's learning about the crops and what grows well in Florida and what kind of inputs are needed and working with growers and producers in the state to kind of do this together. And it's, you know, like we've all said, I mean, there's no promotion behind it. It's strictly, it's learning, it's research. Because ultimately, I think at the end of the day, Zach and others really just want what's best. And shoot, we can't agree on what's best, right? No one, we know that. But we want, you know, we want hemp may be a viable product if it kind of ticks all these boxes, right? And that's the process they're going through right now to see how many boxes that can be ticked. So I don't know, you know, like you said, I mean, people view universities as a relatively trusted and credible source. So starting with some of this baseline research could be a way to go.
Yeah. And another thing that is, I think, really beneficial is stuff like this. Doing that podcast with Zach, with people like him, who normally the public doesn't have access to. Like, you're never just gonna like get to casually chat with Zach Brehm if you're a member of the public. Well, probably because you don't know who each other are, but I think this is a great opportunity for some just casual conversation with someone who is very passionate about it and is an expert about this. I learned so much from Dr. Brehm about hemp production that I never knew. And I think that having podcasts like these, or just different methods of opening up some communication, you know, or insight, other pilot programs seeking to do stuff could do something like this too, to get the Zach Brehms of the world out there chatting about, hey folks, look, we don't know either, we're figuring it out, but this is where we think it's going. Here's what we're doing, what we're not doing. So if anyone listening to this podcast has not listened to the one by Dr. Brehm, you put that plug in there. Go ahead. Check it out.
Well, Dr. Shelley Rampold, soon to be at the University of Tennessee, and not down the hall from us here at the Pi Center and the old Mule Barn. We'll miss you. And thanks so much for being on Science by the Slice.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, I want to thank Dr. Shelley Rampold for being on Science by the Slice. I hope you enjoyed this two-part series on industrial hemp. And maybe after listening to this series, you'll start noticing hemp in more places, whether that's in the news, in the field, or on your grocery store shelves. For more information on the Pi Center's research on public perceptions of hemp in Florida, go to picenter.com. And the easiest way to find it is to just type the word hemp in the search bar at the top of the website. We're going to be releasing all of our new podcast episodes and series on the fourth Wednesday of every month, as we did for this series. Be sure to subscribe to Science by the Slice wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll be notified when those episodes are available. I want to thank my coworkers in the Pi Center who work on Science by the Slice with me, Michaela Kanzer, Sydney Honeycutt, Ricky Telg, Ashley McLeod-Morin, Elena Poulin, and Valentina Castano. I'm Philip Stokes. Thanks for listening to Science by the Slice.